So, Remnant episode 3. Holy shit, this was kind of unexpected. I came to my usual Remnant location to catch up with Francis, and turned out Gigi was in town. I mean, I kind of knew that already, but he was in town, Pablo was in town, and we decided to get together and use it as an opportunity to, of course, record again. And this episode was fucking hilarious. I left a few things in the intro and the outro just to make it feel more organic, because it was really organic. We sat around a table or the bench at Francis's place, and we just spoke about not just the raging Remnant side of things. I mean, I put my little bit of rage in there, but having Gigi in there, you know, obviously mellowed it out a little bit. We heard from Pablo, who is the first time I actually had him on the podcast. Obviously, I've had Francis multiple times and Gigi before as well. You guys might notice something with my voice. So we had a little bit of chocolate with moringa just before the episode started, and I'm assuming that's what happened, because I had this weird allergic reaction when my tongue started to go numb, or at least that's what happened, because I started slurring words and it was like super hard for me to string a sentence. And I started packing shit. I was like, fucking hell, what's going on here? It's like my brain frying or something like that. So anyway, I kind of, at around 40 minutes in, I think I bailed for a little bit to try and figure out what the hell was happening. I came back, tried to string a few more sentences together poorly. So if you do hear some lisping in there, that's why. I haven't gone full retard. It was the moringa, at least. That's what we think it was. In any case, this, of course, catching up with Francis is always a blast. Having Gigi there as well was incredible. Pablo as well, and all the girls that were with us, the wifeys. It was an incredible catch-up. You guys will love this show. It's one of the more mellow-ish Remnant pods, but still like incredible. And I think some of the takeaways as well you guys will really love in there was around, well, at least my favorite takeaway was the Bitcoin being the end of cycles as we know them. And this is something I really want to drive as a concept, because, you know, we all talk about the fourth turning and, you know, the Kardashev cycles, if that's what they're called. I always forget the damn name. But so much bigger than that is what Bitcoin does to the world to remove the cyclical element, or at least the cycles that we've known of to date. Because Bitcoin isn't just a new little technology that got created that will, you know, that's emergent from these cycles. It is the gateway between a type zero and a type one civilization. This is so much bigger than what people are appreciating at the moment. So enjoy the episode. Obviously share this shit around. Subscribe. I've got a bunch of cool episodes going to come up now that we're sort of, I mean, I guess I'm calling this the second season, so there's lots more on the way. Hope you love it, and I'll see you on the next step. This is how Wake Up Podcast start.
Yeah.
Asleep.
Yes.
Chaos. All right. I don't know which episode this is. I'll figure that out later. But on this episode, I have Francis, I have Gigi, I have Alex, and Pablo for one of these episodes. This is Remnant number 3.
Yes.
Is that what we're doing?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Remnant number 3. Okay. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining. We don't have a specific set of topics for this, but we're gonna dive in. But before we dive in, is there any introduction anybody would like to make? I mean, this is actually your first time, so you,
all right,
give us an introduction. You like long walks on the beach? What else do you
like? Like Bitcoin? Have you heard of it?
It's pretty good.
Yeah. No, I'm like Brian Armstrong. We need to find a currency that can, like, you know, not be impacted by inflation and be stable. Yeah, a basket of goods might be a good idea.
A currency board. That's what we need. Yeah.
That's what I'm interested in.
So I'm Pablo. I'm a software engineer by trade, Bitcoiner by heart. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I've been working mainly with Bitcoin for the past 4 years, and pretty much exclusively with Bitcoin stuff for the last 2 years or so. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I'm Argentinian, so Bitcoin, for me, it resonates, and everything Bitcoin means comes very, very close to my heart. So that's why I've decided to dedicate all my effort to make Bitcoin as successful as possible.
Yeah, I remember we met first in Salvador, and I was like, who the fuck is this guy? And then we just got along. Like, I was like, yeah, this guy's one of the crew. So
How did you guys meet? Did you guys organize via Twitter before heading to El Salvador?
No. He was just one of the... I mean, you organized with Breccia, I assume, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. Exactly, yeah. So when we went there, like, he was just one of the only people that I didn't know who it was.
Uh-huh.
And then we met, and we just connected straight away. I was like, fuck, I love this guy.
Right, so, nice. Yeah. And Pablo, you've been kind of, I guess... on the run, quote, trying to figure out where you want to live, trying to figure out what you want to do with your jurisdiction, where your family is going to be established, lifestyle. So, like, can you give us a little background on how long you've been, you know, trying to escape or rebuild a life, or maybe go through your hero stages there?
Yeah, so I've been living in Spain. I was living in Boston before. And I moved to Spain because I met my current wife. So she's Spanish, so I just moved there 8 years ago or 9 years ago. And
you said that almost with some pain in your face. She's Spanish.
Yeah, okay. Spain. I had lived before living in Boston. I had lived for 5 years in Spain, uh-huh. and I was very eager to never go back.
uh-huh.
But she was there, and so I went back. And we've been flirting with the idea of leaving Spain for many, many years. But it's the kind of thing that you keep putting off. With COVID, it became absolutely clear that it was a requirement to not be surrounded by people that are so compliant and are, you know, they are the Asians, you know. They are
the masses.
Yeah.
Yes. And you said something last night about what was the breaking point of you, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So the breaking point was one morning in February 2021. So a year later, after all this stupid stuff started, we used to take our daughter, 2 years old, to the playground, and just on the weekend to the beach outside. Just a slide, a few other things. One day we go in and it's just closed with police tape around it. They also closed the calisthenics park outside on the beach, and they closed it down. And to me, that was my breaking point. To me, this was, we have to get out now.
Yeah.
When was this again?
This was February 2021.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, okay. Yeah. So they hadn't closed it until then?
No, they had been closing and opening, and then they opened.
And then
opened.
The third time, the third time they closed the playground, you're like, the first time you're like, you're laughing at it. I remember the first time they closed a playground with the police.
It's hilarious. I remember the first time I saw the police line, and I did a video on Twitter, and I was just laughing at how stupid it was. But the third time they closed the playground, you're like, oh fuck, like, they're trying to fucking kill me. And especially with children, because this is a family-friendly remnant episode. We've got two remnants that have offspring. You must be thinking with the children, like, okay, this is at a critical development stage of my child's life.
100%.
They are at the where their personality has been formed and all of these values, you know, it's this critical moment. And this is potentially permanent damage we're talking about, right? We are going to be able to heal from this with relative ease. Children may not. So maybe talk about
100%, man, 100%. I remember going to like a big outdoors shop in Spain, and my kid just running around, and parents from other kids seeing my kid approaching, running playfully, just
freaking
the fuck out, man, and grabbing their kid like malaria is coming, or, you know, like something.
It's a reference frame. Like, this is what you just said earlier. It's like, if you start with a reference frame where people are afraid of interacting with others, like, one of my favorite Disney films is WALL-E. You know, with the little
robot.
Robot. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, at the end, like, the humans that are the fat sludge on the on the.
Chairs.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Floating chairs, and they get fed everything, and everything's in front of them. And I used to say that. It was funny, back in 2017 when the the stupid scooters started coming up everywhere.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, this is the pathway to Wally. Because now people aren't walking fucking 50 meters down the road. They're jumping on these stupid scooters. And, you know, we're slowly moving into a reality that looks like that movie. But that... See, one of the lessons in that movie, and countless other movies, is that the masses just don't know any better. And when you set that kind of a reference frame, what you do is you transform all of the new, the incoming, into the same kind of fucking sludge, because they, like, nature is important, but nurture is also...
Well, you know, I think it's mostly about convenience, right? Like, it's if you like, most people, if they have to choose between convenience or the path of hardship, they choose the convenient path. And the price you pay just compounds over a longer period of time. So you will always pay. You will always have a painful path ahead of you. It's just, if you, for example, you know, going to the gym, there is, like, I love the pictures of the gyms that have like roll automatic staircases up to it, or and most people, you know, they won't take the stairs, you know, like, they just to go to the workout, they take the most convenient way possible. And I think it's with all those little decisions, you can always choose to take the hard part and suffer the pain right now, and then it won't compound, or you just, you know, take the convenient path always, and then it compounds after like 10 or 15 years. And I think that's what's happening all over the place now, with health, with fiat, with just how businesses are run, with...
Yeah, it's the optimization of convenience and comfort and safety over freedom and growth. I just want to say one funny anecdote. I actually owned a gym in my early 20s, and I purposely put the gym on the second level so that people had to walk up the stairs, and I fought the fucking local council, so the local government, off. For 1 year, they tried to force me to put a...
disability ramp?
Yeah, exactly, so that people can go up the thing easily. And I was like, no, fuck you. And I won in the end.
Yeah.
I never had to put one. In saying that, that gym ended up shutting down because I let my brother run it. But that's another story.
And it's also, like, regarding the children, it's crazy how young right now the propaganda is happening, younger and younger and younger.
You mentioned this yesterday. Right. Who mentioned it yesterday?
I mentioned it yesterday.
Yeah. And now it's like, as soon as they are basically out of the womb, you know, but realistically, like, you're at a 1.5-year-old, 1-year-old, they're already making the children mimic, you know, the mask ritual, the hands ritual, and the children are just, like, playing adults, right? So it's an adult thing to do, to put the mask on. It's an adult thing to do, to wash your hands all the time. You're not supposed to talk. You're supposed to stay in line quietly. And this is happening at such a young age. I mean, think about all the boomers that were conditioned into the public health hysteria at an age of 30. I don't even know. And then 2 years later, they're still not able at all to deprogram themselves, even with access to the internet, even with protests and all that stuff. Imagine a child. I mean, at least we had, at least the people, you know, that are not children today got to have a normal childhood or something similar that they can then tap into to you know, when you're trying to unlearn this trauma, you can tap into your childhood, at least your memories of that. As a child today, you're just... So I think it's really awesome what you're doing. Is the way that I see it, you're just creating good, positive childhood memories for your child, so that at least they have something. And by the way, congratulations on being so focused on doing this for your kids, because that's one of the reasons why I want to have kids as well. It's like, all the other kids are starting off with such a massive disadvantage.
It's a handicap. Yeah.
They don't even
know they're growing into this thing.
And then as a parent, I mean, I don't know how you feel. I mean, I'm not a parent, but I think about being a parent all the time. And, you know, it's not a competition between your kid and other kids, but kind of it is, you know, you're trying to create the best human for the competition of life. And then everyone else is starting off with a massive handicap. So even if your child has a normal childhood, is already starting off way ahead of everyone else, and if you're specifically going, like, full remnant on the education and providing them with adequate schooling and schooling environments and education, then they have an advantage that they would have had in normal times. Now they're so far ahead. So what you're creating is, like, superhumans. Like, you guys are creating superhumans right now.
100%. But it's very interesting, because when I was speaking about this stuff with friends and family, people that care about me, people that care about my daughter, the message that I was getting back is, well, you are special because you have access to these opportunities, and it's it's unfair of you to think about taking these kind of choices because not everyone can access this kind of choice.
So like guilt tripping you.
Yeah.
Remember Obama? But you didn't build that.
But the brainwash is so insidious that people that care about you are thinking about the public good. You know, mm-hmm. not thinking about, is your daughter okay? Mm-hmm. Is she growing into a world where mm-hmm. she is not mm-hmm. being able to read facial cues? Mm-hmm. She's 2 years old and she's not able to be, she sees every single person in the car, in the, on the TV, mm-hmm. on just walking outside alone, walking their dog with a mask on. They are missing out on learning how to read a fucking facial expression, mm-hmm. man. It's a very, very fundamental concept of communication, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. reading someone else's face.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're not seeing it, man. And it's my daughter, my wife and I, we are like Bitcoiners, remnants, etc. So we're obviously anti all this mask stuff. And my daughter still, she likes to play, to put on a mask.
Yeah.
And I have to dissuade her yeah. from grabbing a mask, and she wants to put it on because she sees everyone yeah, with masks.
Imitation, like that's,
it's imitation, that's man. That's how they learn. That's yeah. how they learn.
Yeah, it's
and washing the hands all the time when she sees like an alcohol thing, like an alcohol bottle, she mm-hmm. wants to put mm-hmm. some on because she's learned. Yeah. Everyone is doing that, so mm-hmm. she thinks that that's how people behave.
It's crazy. Like exposure to sludge is just going down and down and down in age. You know, it started with the internet when we were like I don't know. We're all more or less the same age, but we got exposed to that shit when we were like 13, and then it goes down and down and down and down.
It started with public education. That's
yeah, it did.
The fact
it
that
did.
Public education existed, turned, to, like basically created, it moved a lot of power into the hands of the midwits.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the midwits should have been serfs, they should have been out in the fields digging, they should have been cleaning toilets, they should have been, that's what they should be doing. They shouldn't be in jobs, they shouldn't have any mm-hmm. like, anyway.
I disagree, actually. I think it's mostly about the difference between how to do things properly and like a cargo-cooled way of doing things. And that's why we don't have strict security when you go through the motions at the airport. Like, if you want to blow up a plane, you can blow up a plane. Like, there's no problem. If you want to hurt someone on a plane, you can hurt someone on a plane. No problem. Like, it's security theater. And I think in education it's the same. It's mostly educational theater, you know? Like, come here, sit down at 8 in the morning, and you'll sit at school until 5, and you, quote-unquote, learn stuff, you know? I think also in the investment world, even, you know, it's mostly investment theater. It's like, you know, it's a lot of Silicon Valley kind of... The deal with Silicon Valley is like, you know, pump and dumps in the way of, you know, pump something up, accrue a lot of capital, and exit.
Yeah.
You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's and the way I see it with also now we have hygiene theater, you know, like with the masks and all of it, you can see it very clearly. It's all theater, you know, it's all show.
But do you not think that's a function of having given people all of this? I mean, everything ends up being downstream of broken incentives in the beginning anyway, right? So that's sort of why we're all Bitcoiners and why it's about fix the money. But I think one of the first things that come downstream from being able to fuck with the money and create the wrong incentives is being able to create effectively education for the masses, for people who don't need it. Like, these people otherwise would have maybe become artisans and artists and bakers and carpenters and farmers and all these other shit, but they've gone and created a high level of mediocre input into a series of fucking mindless jobs and mindless industries where everything's just become theater because that's not what they're designed to do.
Yeah, I agree with that. Like, there's definitely most jobs, especially like a lot of the white collar jobs, they're like not real jobs. Like, they're bullshit jobs. They're like theater jobs to stick with the theme. You know, like, you go into the office, you sit in your cubicle, you, I don't know, stare at an Excel sheet for 8 hours a day, mm-hmm. and then you go home. And mm-hmm. I think that's also where a lot of the depression and nihilism comes from, mm,
yeah.
where, you know, like, you resort to drinking yourself to death on the weekends, or you just...
I was talking about that with your wife last night.
Yeah.
I was talking about that with your wife last
yeah.
night, yeah.
So that's the I think, the sad reality for, I don't know, like, probably, like, 30% or more of the white-collar
80.
Workforce.
Yeah,
80.
Yeah,
maybe,
yeah,
might be 80, yeah.
Yeah.
If you stick with the 80-20 rule, then you're mm, probably right.
100%.
Yeah.
And the thing is that once you start going down that path, it starts capturing people, because now there is a gap in between the reality that you're seeing on the ground and the type of job that you do. You notice that the job that you're doing is worthless. It doesn't mean anything. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean anything. Yeah. So now the your gap between what you're seeing and what you're feeling and recognizing what you're seeing gets increasingly larger, right? So it's like a sunk cost fallacy, mm-hmm. where your only way out is to dig in
I think that's also how people end up at the conclusion that nothing is real and nothing matters, right?
Yeah,
I think that's why so many people, like why Bitcoin gives hope to so many people, because Bitcoin is definitely real, and it, like, there is no, it has like a zero bullshit tolerance also in how it operates, you know, like everything is there for a reason and everything kind of feeds into the system directly. Like, there is no bullshit mechanism in Bitcoin that's completely useless or anything like that.
Yes.
And I think that wakes a lot of people up that, you know, there is a base reality. And I mean, other things do that as well, you know, like if you, I don't know, move somewhere else, like move to India for 2 years, you realize suddenly that you need to have basic things met for you in order to survive, or people, you know, move to a farm and become farmers, and then things are very real very quickly, as opposed to in your cubicle where everything is taken care of.
Well, it's about how close consequences are to actions.
Exactly.
And that's the thing, like, in my mind, Bitcoin fixes the world because it brings consequence right next to action.
Yeah,
that's what's missing in the world today. It's like, me and your wife were talking about this yesterday. I was like, the fiat solution to any problem is to remove the signal that tells you there's a problem. So if, you know, we've got pain receptors, if you know, we have a pain receptor, if you put your hand on the stove and it starts to burn, you know, your body tells you this is painful, so you can move it. And the fiat solution to this is
take painkillers
exactly. Well, and then put your hand on there and leave it on there. Or the best analogy for me is actually flying a plane. And the altimeter is saying that there's a fucking mountain ahead, and like everyone's freaking out, and someone's like, "I have an idea. Remove the altimeter. We're okay."
Yeah.
Right into the fucking mountain.
Absolutely. And at a fundamental level, with interest rates, like, it is actually what they are doing.
That's exactly what it is.
With the price of borrowing money, right?
Chris, creates a cushion between the consequence and the action, and then you have no way of knowing whether you're actually making the appropriate action, whether it's right, whether it's wrong, you know, then maybe at some point you do get a consequence, but you don't actually know what the fucking consequence is for. Maybe you made a bunch of bad decisions, then you finally make one good decision, but then the consequence catches up to you. So you think the good decision is the bad one, and you're like,
again, it just compounds, you know, like it just delays and compounds and compounds and compounds, and then you are in completely unknown territory because you don't know what's going to happen, you know, like there are so many, like, the errors compound, and then it's just unknowable. Like, how we all know, for example, the current financial system is going to collapse. How it collapses exactly is kind
Nobody
of an
knows
unknown.
Exactly.
You know? Right. Like, it's like, of course, it's like, if the building is going to fall, which exactly, how is it going to fall exactly? You don't know. You know, it's not going to be standing.
To go back to the Wall-E example, you know, like, if you just go on your scooter or your flying chair all the time, never work out and only eat potato chips, like, I can't tell you what's going to happen with you in 20 years. Like, are you going to get a heart attack or an artery clogging up or whatever? I can't tell you, but something is going to happen. You know, it's, again, compounded error.
And again, to bring back Ron Feld and Nassim, because we don't know what's going to happen, the only thing you can do is make yourself anti-fragile to any kind of situation, so that whatever exterior consequence or exterior condition is imposed upon you, you are in a position where you become stronger as a result. So that's usually in the uncertainty of the future, you make yourself anti-fragile to multiple possibilities. And so something I want... So Gigi, you're an optimist, I would say. I would describe you as an optimist. A few times where I've had, I felt nihilistic, you know, we chatted a few times and you helped me have a more optimistic mindset. And then recently, I've also been interested in the whole cycle theory that's being discussed. Mark Moss was talking about the cycle theory, and Laser started to talk about multiple cycles that are converging.
I mean, there's the fourth turning, there's like even longer cycles, everything kind of comes to... currently.
And at the point where we're at now, and the kind of point I want to make is, okay, so we are four people that are right now in the jungle, and we've met. So the remnant are meeting. We are actually starting to see this. And then the theory of the masses and the collapse of the Western civilization cycle, the technology cycle, the monetary cycle. I think we're kind of understanding that everything is hitting the fan, the multiple different bubbles are popping, and then now we're at the inflection point where you've got the kind of hope Bitcoin cycle that is starting to emerge, and the despair nihilistic cycle of fiat, which is, you know, I think we're getting close to that point where the two cycles are crossing over. Yeah. And then so you've talked about, you know, Bitcoin being spiritual, Bitcoin being religious. You've talked about metaphysical, philosophical, historical aspects of Bitcoin. So give us like the positive, hopeful take on this, right? So we are the remnant. We're here. We're actually in the same room. We're talking about raising families. We're talking about building a new future. Can you paint us the Gigi? Like, what does Gigi see in his mind that keeps him hopeful? Right?
I don't know. It's a great question. I think there are kind of multiple things that. Multiple strategies for the next like 5 to 10 years. One of them is exiting, you know, and I think what makes me hopeful is that all of it is possible. You can definitely exit. You can, like, if you use and understand Bitcoin properly, Bitcoin is something that will give you a very deep stability and no one can interfere with it. No one can take it away from you. You know, mm-hmm. like they can, even if you, you know, like, they will have to torture you out of your Bitcoin, and depending on how good your setup is and how well you train your mind, like, you will take your Bitcoin to your grave. And, you know, there are things like time locks and stuff that aren't explored very well yet. So there's just, in terms of wealth preservation and giving you the highest amount of optionality, mm-hmm. Bitcoin is an insane and amazing tool. Like, it's defensive technology.
And right, and even we've had this discussion, not defensive only against others, but against your own self. Like, you can live in a bus, and keep your Bitcoin safe. You can live super poor for 5 years, and we've talked about
you can be a Bitcoiner and no one knows.
Right, right. Yeah. You can become a hermit, and it is a valid actual strategy to be like, I'm going to check out of this insanity for a few years.
I mean, you know, like, if it's currently, I think we are in very turbulent times, and it's just unknown how things will shake out in the next like 1 or 2 years, and it might be a valid strategy to do that until the dust has settled, you know.
Right.
Like, that's one optimistic path, kind of optimistic in the sense that you don't have to be caught up in the insanity, because when you get up caught up in the insanity, it's very, very difficult to stay optimistic and hopeful. You know, like, exiting is definitely one path that one can take, and Bitcoin enables that. You know, like, if you, depending on how early you discovered Bitcoin, and depending on how early you understood that DCA is the way, depending on how early you were able to save yourself, that's a path you can take. And right. I also think it's not too late yet. You know, like, if you're just very new, you can still DCA, and just, you would be surprised how, especially, we're still in the exponential monetization curve of Bitcoin. So if you DCA just for 1 year, you have optionality for 3 years, probably.
Right,
Probably, you know.
Yeah.
And so that's definitely a path. In general, what has me very optimistic is that fiat is designed to destruct itself. You know, so. Mm-hmm. So this is crystal clear, even if you don't know anything about Bitcoin. All the macro people agree, everyone agrees that it's only downward from there. There's no going back, you know, like, the nations have to default, and there's no way we're going to pay back all our debt. And just, fiat currencies have the property of returning to their intrinsic value and their value of production, which is zero, basically, you know, printing paper, one computer stroke, it's there is no value to be found there. And Bitcoin is exactly the opposite, which, it has a very deep stability, and it will survive all that, and it will stick around. You know, like, that's it. It will, no matter how turbulent the times are, as long as we don't have complete elimination of all humans on the planet, Bitcoin will still be there. You know, like, there will be one person insane enough to mine and run a node, and so on and so forth. Like, it's pure information, and it's insanely resilient. Like, I've never seen a more resilient system. The only thing that comes close is life itself. You know, like, that's. You know, if there's nuclear holocaust worldwide, the cockroaches will probably survive.
Yeah.
And for a time, you know, there are some server farms underground. Bitcoin will survive as well, but, you know, needs some maintenance and so on. So.
Not the as cockroaches good as cockroaches. Will be running Bitcoin.
Mining Bitcoin.
Who knows? Who knows?
So fiat has an expiration date that's built in.
Yeah.
And then, fiat being the root of the... So how do we distinguish between fiat, like self-destructing, and then that opens up the door for Bitcoin? Yeah. And then what about the reconciliation? What about, what is it, do you think? So what makes you hopeful that people are going to adopt different values? Like, how is Bitcoin going to change people? Because what if Bitcoin, they use Bitcoin,
yeah,
and they still go into that collectivism? What's you think is the mechanism that stops that from happening?
I think that's where the kind of religious / spiritual properties kind of come in. And I say, like, take everything I say there with a grain of salt, you know, like I have to use religious language because nothing else really works. But if you understand Bitcoin properly and if you use it properly, it's very individualistic in the same sense that, you know, Christianity, for example, it focuses on the sovereignty of the individual. You know, the individual, the soul is holy, kind of. It's like the soul is untouchable. You know, like you decide, kind of.
Yeah, nobody can take your soul away from
exactly.
you.
Exactly.
Only God can do that.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, only God is right. able to judge you. And yeah. you have free will and you are sovereign in your actions and so on. And Bitcoin is exactly the same. You know?
Right.
And Bitcoin, because you define for yourself what Bitcoin is. And I think it's two things. And there's another thing I want to come back to. But if you use Bitcoin properly, it will lower your time preference. As long as we are in the monetization phase of Bitcoin, it will lower your time preference. Uh-huh. Like, there's no other way around it. You will see that Bitcoin appreciates exponentially and everything else compared to it depreciates. Mm-hmm. So spending a Bitcoin is a bad idea. The opportunity cost is almost infinite. You know, like, doing anything else, buying anything else instead of Bitcoin, you will regret it like 5 years down the road. And and I think most people that stick around for a while and realize that and are just looking at the numbers, they will realize that. So it will lower your time preference and it will remove you from what Pierre calls the high velocity fiat economy, you know, like the trash economy, just, you know, buy, consume at any price. So you will definitely become more conservative in your spending, you know. And you know, the Keynesians will tell you that this is bad and the economy will grind to a halt, but that's completely untrue, because you still need to breathe, you still need to eat, you still need to drink, you still need to have housing and so on and so forth, you know. It's just reducing your footprint, kind of. And the second thing is, and this is where the individual thing comes in, you have to define for yourself what Bitcoin is. No one can tell you what Bitcoin is. You have to decide, okay, this is the implementation I want to run, these are the consensus rules that are Bitcoin for me. And it's also, you have to take full responsibility. You have to hold your own keys. Otherwise, you're not using Bitcoin. You're using IOUs. If you are not running your own node, if you are not validating your own transactions, you're not using Bitcoin. You're using someone else's understanding of Bitcoin. And that's where, you know, that's why I think religious language is so perfect. Because it's, in many religions, it's the same, you know, like you decide what God is for you. You decide what kind of sets of rules you want to follow. And if other people overlap, you have your own little sect, you know, that are in agreement with yourself. But no one else can overrule you, you know. I can't tell you what your God is, for example. You know, you have to decide for yourself. And Bitcoin is very much alike.
Yeah, for me, it was something very interesting. I got a Bitcoin tattoo. And when I mentioned to my family that I was going to get a Bitcoin tattoo, the reaction that I got back was, well, what if you change your mind? You know, what if you start liking it?
Yeah.
What if, you know?
Yes.
And it's
what if another one takes over? Exactly. And then you've got the MySpace tattoo. You know?
exactly. And it's so insidious, because what I get back when I present, this is the conclusion of what I've been researching, what I've been reading, what I've been studying, what I've been experiencing, is, well, it's your conclusion now. But what if you change your mind? Mm-hmm. You know? And It's very interesting, because I noticed that most people, and the mass, right? Most people, they believe that there is no truth and that everything is negotiable. Everything is relative, right? And they start exactly, but they start from that framework. So they observe everything from that framework. So if there is no truth and you can't reach any conclusion, nothing really matters, right?
Yeah.
You know that there. I think one of the points that I was making regarding Marxism is that the root of Marxism is social constructivism in the social sciences, and that's why, you know, as you say, since reality is subjective and the societal norms or a social construct, then we can start with something that doesn't exist as a premise and extrapolate. But with Bitcoin, what's really amazing is that at some point, the rabbit hole never ends, in the way that there is always something to learn about Bitcoin, but at some point you
You hit ground zero.
You hit ground zero, and then there is an illumination part of the Bitcoin journey, and I think we've all kind of felt it in different ways. We've talked about this both.
Yeah.
I've been in a kind of constant state of illumination for enlightenment for quite a while. For some people, it's more dramatic. It's quicker. And then it's almost as if...
I think that's where it becomes binary. And Pablo and I talked about this today in the morning, that it's like once you are at that point, it's either Bitcoin will work and it will eat up everything. So one single Satoshi will be worth almost infinity, kind of, you know?
Yeah.
Or there is something that makes it not work. I cannot tell you what it is. Like I can't even think of anything that could pop up to make it not work.
Mm-hmm.
But still, like if this happens, then Bitcoin will be worth zero, you know, it will implode. So it is very binary.
Yeah.
And the example I gave to Pablo is like free speech is like that. If you think very deeply about the value of free speech, it's also very binary. You know, like if you want to have a free society, free speech is absolutely
paramount. You're correct.
There is no, like, and once you understand that, there's like no turning back from that. It's not like only a little bit of free speech.
There is no asterisk.
Yeah,
there is no, you have to
be like a free speech maximalist if you're serious about free speech and if you understand the implications properly.
The block is valid or it's not valid. It's not kind of valid.
Yeah.
It could be valid depending on the circumstances.
Yeah, same thing.
Yeah.
This is why, so I did a podcast recently with Laser, with Mark, and with Joel.
Uh-huh.
And who else was on it? Fuck, someone else was on it, but I can't remember. Anyway, the point that I made there was like, the cycles don't matter. Like Bitcoin doesn't just, you know, where everyone talks about how Bitcoin breaks all the models. Like, I think Bitcoin breaks all the cycles. So, you know, we're talking about all these cycles converging and everything. These cycles are all a function of us having been a premature human race up until now. So I think Bitcoin is the thing that gets us through the great filter and moves us into becoming like a type one civilization, etc. But like, for me, I heard this from MVK where he said, Bitcoin's the final Cantillon effect.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's the final time we're going to get an advantage.
Yeah, and after
that, like, it's the door. Like, we open that
door.
All these previous cycles, like the Kardashev cycle and the fourth turning horse shit, like, all that crap, it's gone. There is no cycles because cycles are predicated on the fact that there is no truth and that the truth is dependent upon which component of the cycle we're in.
Yeah.
That all disappears.
Right.
Like, so you guys were talking before about, like, what happens to humanity, like can we get rid of the sludge, etc. So I've kind of written here is like what we become on a, you know, post sort of this, the door opening and us sort of walking through the door, is we get low time preference humans who focus on morality and the preservation of their bloodline.
Right.
Now this is going to sound elitist, but I'm an elitist, I don't give a fuck, is that this like Bitcoin ushers in the new age of kings and queens and of lords and noble families, like the real elite. The real remnant, like this is what happens. Like Bitcoin is a remnant technology fundamentally, and what happens is the best rise, and we are the ones who begin to effectively rule the universe. And it's not rule to control others; it's rule to preserve one's bloodline, to preserve the purity of what you want to create. And it's very different from the parasites. So I kind of view humanity in sort of three categories. It's the natural elite, that's the remnant. The parasites, who are the fake elites, they're always jealous of the remnant. And the masses.
Right, sure,
and
yes.
What the
yes,
parasites
yeah,
do is they
yeah,
get the
good.
Masses
yeah, yeah.
to go and burn down the remnant.
Right. So very good point that I like a lot of people that are not remnant. And when we're talking about remnant versus sludge and all that, I had this discussion multiple times. We talked about it last time. I'm struggling with, I don't want to dehumanize average people, right? I don't want to. The thing is, the parasite has weaponized the masses against us, so that we normally would not want to interact with a large portion of society. We don't want to control them. We don't want to have. We're not trying to replace the current establishment by us so that we can control the masses impose our values on them. What I do want for us to achieve with Bitcoin and with this movement is to disarm them so that they do not have the, like, almost as an attrition, like, you guys do not have the physical capacity and resources and capital and all of that to attack me. So I don't want to control, I don't want to have a remnant takeover of society. I want to have a remnant exit from society where, and we've been trying to exit for a while. I mean, we're here right now. We're literally exiting, but they won't let us exit. You know, that's the thing.
The masses will always default to what is the default. Yeah. So if the default is tyranny and gulags and everything like that,
correct, right,
they'll be happy with that.
So this
but
is what,
if the remnant creates a default that is, you know, freedom and prosperity and trade and free markets, the masses will default to that.
Yeah,
and they'll be happy.
Yeah. So this is kind of like where the optimism comes in. Yeah. The optimism part comes in is by, okay, so, and that's where I'm kind of like trying to dig in. Are we going to convince the masses? Is that what's going to happen? No, we cannot convince them, that's for sure, right? Mm-hmm. So what is the mechanism by which, and I think you're getting close to the, if we make the Bitcoin standard and the non-aggression principle and the valuation of human prosperity and genuinity and progress, these just the default behaviors, then to go into authoritarian route would require a lot of energy and effort and cunning and all of that, and the masses just don't have that impetus to go into the authoritarian route, because that becomes the higher hanging fruit, you know, the path of least resistance.
I think it's two things, or maybe even three things, but I think it's the most people will be convinced by economic reality, and that's what happened the last 10 years. It's number
one. That's the Pierre Richard. People need to eat.
Yeah, exactly. That's like the, you know, like also Saifedean makes this point all the time. It all doesn't matter over a long enough time scale. If you adopt Bitcoin, you will be like, you will economically survive longer than everyone else. Mm-hmm. And this is a very easy argument to make. Mm-hmm. It's like, it has been historically accurate. It will be historically accurate as long as Bitcoin keeps working. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's number one. And I think that's the main driver. I think the second one is exactly what you said, Alex, is like providing the defaults, kind of, which means building. Mm-hmm. Today, end-to-end encryption in most messengers is the default.
Yes.
People did not know, they don't need to know about end-to-end encryption. They don't need to care about open source software. Mm-hmm. They don't need to care about the definition of free software. They don't need to know about, you know, the GNU public license. They don't need to know who Richard Stallman is, you know, like,
yeah, right.
No one has to care. Yeah, everyone is using end-to-end encrypted software. Mm-hmm. And I think the same will be true in Bitcoin. We need the purity and the radical core to protect the values of Bitcoin and protect the network, protect the software and so on and so forth, make the right decisions. And you have to be, it's again, back to the free speech argument. You have to be radical about that, you know, like 21 million is non-negotiable,
right?
You know, like there are certain slippery slopes that will lead you down the destruction and capture of Bitcoin. That's like why I disagree, for example, currently with Udi and other
I was
people.
Just going to name him. Udi, we're talking about you.
That, you know, it's very important. Like, for example, with I mean, we went through this and Udi as a software engineer for sure knows, you know, like Richard Stallman is a radical, and you cannot make an exception when it comes to free software.
Yeah.
You have to protect the four freedoms at all costs. Otherwise, it's not free software.
Yeah.
And with Bitcoin, for example, it's about it's more difficult even, because it's very difficult to box in kind of what Bitcoin is. But the best we can do is like 21 million.
Yeah.
If you hard fork, 21 million is kind of in danger. So,
yes.
You know, hard forks are very, very problematic, just to give you one example. You know? And I think it's about building and providing sane defaults to people. No one cares about Linux. No one cares about Linux kernel development. Half of the population is using Android, which is Linux. You know, no one knows that they're using Linux.
The best example I use is Henry Ford. He said, if I asked people what they wanted, they would have said faster horses.
Right.
He built the fucking car for a small subset of people, and the car became the default. Nikola Tesla didn't build electricity for fucking what everybody understood, right? He built electricity. Oh, he didn't build electricity. He discovered how to harness electricity, and he did it for a specific subset of people who really got it, and it became the default. Yeah. So the masses always, they're like inertia, and what the remnant represents is the initiating force. The inertia will default towards what the initiating force
but
is.
But it's also, it's always individual choices, and everyone will have to learn at their own time, you know? Like, because if you're getting deplatformed for whatever reason, it might be political speech, it might be sex work, it doesn't matter what, you know? Like, currently you can be deplatformed for absolutely anything. Bitcoin will be there for you. And that's like, you know, end-to-end encryption. Like, if someone is snooping on you for whatever reason, end-to-end encryption will be there for you. Mm-hmm. And it's the same, the same is true for, you know, like, if you want to, I don't know, like, sell something, it doesn't matter if it's in person or online, and you, for whatever reason, have no access to financial infrastructure or a bank account or what have you, or cannot create a PayPal account, Bitcoin will be there for you. Mm-hmm. And it's only getting better and easier, and in the end, people really do not care what they use, you know? Like, it just has to work. And I think that's the like the second piece of the puzzle. Like, the first one is number go up, it will convince most people. The second one is having the same defaults and having things work flawlessly, you know, like as well as they do now in the fiat system in terms of UX and how quickly you can make this happen and use it and all of it. And we're really close. I think we're really close. Like, case in point, last weekend, we went to the beach, we went to a market, and someone was producing art and was like, you know, I'm Bitcoin friendly. We saw it on the thing, and it's like, what? You're Bitcoin friendly? Like, BTC friendly? What the hell? And she had, you know, like a Lightning wallet. And yeah, if you want to buy it, just pay me in Lightning. So we're already really close. It's just that I think most people don't know that this exists and that this world exists, but they will learn if they have to learn. Like, my main go-to example is always the Arab Spring. No one knew about routing or DNS settings or Tor or firewalls or what have you. Government shuts down the internet, people learned in 24 hours.
Yeah.
There were graffitis on the walls, you know, change your DNS settings to this and that, install that Tor browser or what have you, and you're back online again. You know, so people, if shit really hits the fan, people will learn really quickly.
I'll give you a good example of that. I've told this story a few times on other podcasts, the Backpage story, where, long story short, in 2015, a lot of sex workers are now prevented from placing ads for their erotic services online because PayPal and Visa, MasterCard, and PaySafeCard have financially censored their website Backpage. And they had to learn how to use Bitcoin very quickly. And we're talking about somewhere around the lines of 100,000 people that are female and trans, mostly sex workers, that are obviously low income, low education, ghetto, you know, and then they all were able to install Bread Wallet to buy Bitcoin at the ATMs, to send Bitcoin online, to pay their ads within 3 days. It was absolutely unfathomable. And that is the time where I became very radical about Bitcoin, where I really understood the Pierre Rochard argument, which was one specific instance where I have this lady over the phone and she's crying because she's a prostitute, she needs to do what she does to get some money to feed her kids. She's crying. She's like, I don't know what to do. I need Bitcoin. Can you help me? Can you help me? And I'm like, calmly. And we explained to her how to download the thing, how to do that. And then the desperation for Bitcoin was so strong. It was like, I need Bitcoin to survive, exactly like we said would happen. And then, because it's the only thing that the merchant will accept and provide her. And then the fact that she was able to pull it off within 12 hours was phenomenal. I want to dig in on what you said, the end of history with Bitcoin. Bitcoin is the end of the cycle. Just so you know, in political science, there was this big debate in the 90s and the early 2000s between
Francis Fukuyama,
Fukuyama versus Huntington. Huntington, the clash of civilizations, said that people are going to tribalize around these kind of like meta sets of values like Confucius and like Western civilization. And Francis Fukuyama is saying that, no, actually, neoliberal globalism, nation state democracy is the end. We've finally achieved this like UN happy whatever kumbaya.
Disgraced your name, man.
Yeah, I know he did. He is the worst. I mean, there's a lot of bad Francis's out there, the Pope and Fukuyama. Yeah. But then okay, so we have this. This is like the end of history model, and then we have Mark Moss and Laser and a bunch of people talking about the cycles model, which I think intuitively makes a lot of sense to me. And then you have I think Alex's model is like the Prometheus model, which is like God or the universe provided fire to man, then Bitcoin, and then that was like step one, and then we're civilization, and then now we have Bitcoin, and now, you know, all the cycles of iteration that was pre-fire, we don't know where they were, but they are there. It's just the great apes, you know, all of that, all those are over. Now we are man, okay, and now we are like Homo Bitcoinicus,
yes.
Right?
That's
the Homo Bitcoinicus. There's only two things that happen, fire and Bitcoin. And then, if you think about, you have Save Dean who makes a very compelling case in the Fiat Standard and Bitcoin Standard that it's man's compulsion to devalue the money. So what is it that you think Bitcoin, like, why does Bitcoin break the cycles? From a sociology and psychology point of view, is it why couldn't someone, for example, start to fractional reserve Bitcoin? Or isn't there going to be another movement? Like, are they going to screw up what we did in 300 years? Like,
they'll try, because but the problem is what Bitcoin does is it brings what I said earlier, consequence next to action, and you can try and camouflage as much of that, you know, that you can try and create a distance between the consequence and the action,
right?
But the gap will quickly close, and the compounding effect of not doing so and compounding the amount of Bitcoin territory you have,
right,
is going to give you such an advantage over the clown who's trying to do it, you know, in a cheating sort of way.
Right, like, right.
We've never had a substance or a mechanism via which we can measure, you know, resources, time, energy, and human action like Bitcoin can. Like, it's the map that sits directly on the territory, and you can't lie. Because at the moment, we're all using maps, and we kind of said this earlier, is that we're using maps that don't have a relationship to the territory. Right. We're all lying to each other. We're all playing this fucking game, and nothing makes sense.
Yeah,
it's one way to say this is because basically what you're saying, how can we be sure that there's not a foolish system built on top of it?
Right, and sure, exactly.
The thing is that, for example, you cannot fool nature. Mm-hmm. You know, like if you're building a moon rocket, or if you, doesn't matter what you do, nature will always win.
That's true.
Nature is reality. Reality will always win. You cannot fool nature. You cannot fool reality. And to quote Hesmer Cook, you know, Bitcoin is nature. It is like, that's why I say it's like a biological system. You know, like it's, there is no way to fool it in the sense that you cannot fool gravity. Mm-hmm. You know, it will always, even if you fractionally reserve Bitcoin, it will come crashing down. You know,
yeah, like, and the fact that it's a voluntary system, and it remains a voluntary system, even if you choose to not use the voluntary system and you go for a fractional reserve banking because it's easier, it's, you know, it has nicer colors or whatever. The fact that that choice is still there, it means that you can always go back to the truth. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You can go back to the source truth.
Exactly. It's like it's what you're doing is fractional reserving IOUs. You know, there's no other way. It's just like with gold. You know, like gold still works. It's just gold has the shortcomings. We all know. You know, you can't, you can't teleport it across space. Like that's the main issue with gold. You know, and it's, I think the fact that it's so easy to verify Bitcoin, and that it is weightless, I think this is enough to for it to win out in the monetary realm. Like the design space of money is limited, and Bitcoin is like basically almost 10 out of 10 on all the vectors of the design space of money. That's also why I'm so sure, you know, like Bitcoin will it's not the MySpace of money. It isn't. Yeah. It is like, it is the end, you know, like gold was insanely close, and now the last, like if you look at the Jörg Hermsdorf, a German Bitcoiner, he did an amazing talk. It's also available in English now. It's the last money. And Bitcoin truly is the last money. And gold was insanely close. Just gold is not informational. Gold is physical. And that's the problem. If something is physical, if something has mass, you cannot teleport it. You cannot communicate it across a communications channel. And that's what Bitcoin fixed. And now we're at the end, you know. It's very similar to like how binary code is at the end. It's zero and one. And you can encode any information with just zeros and ones. You can't go smaller. You know, like the design space of information is also limited. And DNA encodes it with like four letters, but it's just because it's self-correcting. It's again like zero and one, but it's GATC, and they are paired with each other, so they have a self-correcting mechanism built in. But in the end, it's binary. You know, and so I view Bitcoin as like if you look at the design space of money, Bitcoin is like. It's the end. Mm-hmm. It's like we don't need to improve upon it.
It's the discovery of energy money. Like that's the thing. That's like it is any sentient species. Like it's the solution to the whole Fermi paradox. Is like if a sentient species anywhere, maybe in another fucking galaxy on the other end of the universe, they discovered it and they called it fucking Arscoin or something. I don't know. Like it's. I don't know, but that's kind of like,
I think they would view Bitcoin as
insanely creative name.
Thank you.
No, I cannot wait, Satoshi. I cannot wait to discover other civilizations if we ever do during my lifetime, which is objectively unlikely. But just to see, is this a universal law? Like, is Bitcoin the last money university, or is it the last money for Homo sapiens because we have certain, you know, is it the objective truth of like all the universe?
I mean, you definitely. If you have a sufficiently complex system,
it is probably energy. Is probably the currency of the universe.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's also what Henry Ford talked about, right? Or was it Ford? I'm not sure.
Yeah, it was Ford. Money. Yeah,
and
those Bucky.
No, but Ford also.
Oh, it might be. Yeah, yeah, but it's not. It's not a new idea. You know, like energy is the currency of the universe, and every sufficiently complex system will run into coordination problems. So, so you have kind of cells and. You cannot know anything, like you cannot know everything about the whole system. Your knowledge is always limited. Mm-hmm. So you have to trade information with the other parts of the system. And that's how money emerges also in the biological realm. You know, Brandon Quidham talked about this a lot, how fungal networks trade nutrients and stuff like that. You will always run into this problem. It's an information theoretical problem.
Holy
you
know, shit. Like,
no, it really is.
Holy shit.
What's up?
Okay, so for people...
And so yes. The currency of the universe is energy. And you will always have the same... issue always, and so if you try to map the currency that you have, like plants do the same, like for them energy is nutrients, so they trade nutrients, you know, and for like the closer you come to something that represents pure energy, the better you are, and that's why Bitcoin is and the design space it's exactly it's the perfect one. You can't cheat energy.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but you just gave me an illumination while you were talking. Thank you. You see, messianic currency, getting all these illuminations. For those who have read the three body problem, I'll just give you a little hint because I don't want to ruin the book for a lot of people. But the dark forest theory is the Byzantine general's problem. I'll just say this, but there's no more Byzantine general problem than different species in the universe coordinating over extremely large space and time distances. So it's like a
one more time, because you asked if Bitcoin is like the end all be all. It definitely is for us, but we must not forget that our physical universe has very real limitations and. Bitcoin has like a 10-minute light radius around the Earth. Yeah, if someone wants to read up on that, Ruth Bansal, Bitcoin Astronomy, I think is the name of the piece. It's like two or three parts now. And the reason is that we are limited by light speed. And so all the nodes in the network have to coordinate in, and we have a 10-minute block time. So we have a limited amount of time to coordinate a new state for the whole network. And so that's why you cannot mine on Alpha Centauri or not even on Mars, you know, like Mars is like 7 minutes away.
So that's an incentive to break the laws of physics somehow, isn't it?
No, it's an incentive to reach for the stars, and you can bring your own like proof of work chain with you.
So I actually think what will happen is there'll be trade amongst sentient species who have their own currencies, so there are versions of Bitcoin, which will have a relative market value against each other, because and it'll be kind of based on, do I want Bitcoin because Bitcoin represents the total productive capacity of humans or Homo Bitcoinicus, or do I want to hold the other currency, which is Homo Ascoinicus, who, you know, that they have
trillions of blocks already.
Well, at the end of the day, you can see on
this
the block,
six stars already.
You can see on the block the amount of proof of work that went into producing the block. So you can see the amount of energy that was behind a different block. So even if
And here's the future of the remnant. So I'm going to do the last piece now, just for me, and then I'm going to take a rest. But what the remnant will do, so the kings and queens that Bitcoin emerges, they will go out to new solar systems and they will go and create their own versions of Bitcoin energy money on those systems, and that their bloodline will run those worlds.
Yes. Okay, let's write.
There will be Svetsky planet, there will be Francis planet.
I mean, honestly, I like to say, if you take the extremist radical time preference view, this is exactly what you would do. You would see, for every time I'm buying a beer, I am literally preventing a dynastic 1,000 years down the line from at least 7 or 6 battle cruisers. That's kind of like the going rate for battle cruisers, like 0.0017 or less than that or something. But speaking about the remnant, for people who don't know, the remnant is a text by Isaiah's Job. I just want Gigi to like maybe touch on the concept of synchronicity and how, because we have had these discussions. I know it's a very large question to just throw Gigi. Hey, Gigi, explain the synchronicity to people. but how does so? I mean, to some degree, we've had the transformation, all of us internally. So we first went through that transformation, and now we're on some kind of other frequency, or we see the world in some way where we are gradually, as a community, and I mean, I am going to use the word Bitcoin community, even though it's a controversial word, because I do think there is a kind of Bitcoin remnant, maximalist, toxic, cypherpunk community, or at least a subset of people, which I don't know how to define it, but we definitely understand that we're in the same community. When we meet each other, it's like, it's hard to define, but once you have the object in front of you, there's an instant recognition.
One thing we were talking about before that is related to this before the recording is, I was telling them that there is Bitcoin the money, and then there's Bitcoin the network, and then there's Bitcoin the framework of thinking that takes you to understand and use like a proxological approach to understand reality.
So
I think what you're talking about is people. The, like the Bitcoin community is people that align with thinking in Bitcoin terms.
Yeah.
You know, using Bitcoin as a framework of thinking.
And it's not even it's a post Bitcoin community in the sense that we are already living in the post-Bitcoin world, and we're just by ourselves, right?
The Bitcoin standard is already here. It's just not very evenly distributed yet.
I
have a very simple answer to your question in regards to explaining synchronicity and those kind of weird things that seem to happen. And I think it's just because Bitcoin synchronizes. That's what it does. It's literally what it does. It's its whole purpose. And so for me, it's not surprising that the people that you know, like, engage with this thing and have like are like 5,000 or 10,000 hours in, that you will kind of synchronize your brain with the other people that went through the 5,000 or 10,000 hours.
Yeah.
Because you will have read the same text, you will have read the same authors, you will have seen the same memes, you know, you have watched the same, even like fictional material, you know, like, I'm pretty sure every one of us has read, you know, 1984, V for Vendetta, and all those kind of, you know, Snow Crash, all those kind of Bitcoin edits and things that try to explain some aspect of Bitcoin, you know, like it's, you know, you have to understand like the authoritarian dystopias to understand what Bitcoin protects you from, for example, you
know?
And also for Snow Crash, for example, it's very useful to think of Bitcoin as a drug. That's why we're talking about the orange pill, you know, or as a religion. And so very similar to Stevenson's universe, you know, there's this thing that changes people and like a cult built around it, and it affects minds and it affects computers.
Yeah.
And that's a very nice framework to think about that as well. And I think that's part of what's currently happening, that a lot of people that knew that kind of the current system isn't working for them or just isn't working, period, and that found out that it's gonna self-implode. I think a lot of people were just very nihilistic and pessimistic and just, you know, gave up. And once you find a solution to that, it's also very easy to get in tune with other people that had the same realizations and found the same solution.
Yeah.
You know?
Like,
And I would say it's not unique to the Bitcoin quote unquote community. You know,
right.
Like there are other like other things where you have like a wake up realization moment and other people went through the same thing and then you immediately connect. And I think what's funny is you can absolutely tell, you know, like if you start talking with someone, you can absolutely tell. This one, is he or she part of the few or not?
And that's why sometimes there's when we talk about the religious aspect, I think we're talking about an unseen metaphysical aspect that feels religious in a way. It really does feel religious. We do have the sense of enlightenment, the sense of former self, like born again Bitcoiner, and you see the world in
it's
a different
sense
way now.
Inevitability, right?
A sense of destiny and sense of fate, and then us coming up with same ideas all around the world at the same time. And of course, there is a rational, logical way to explain it. As you just say, we read the same things, but
it definitely does not feel rational. It's very similar, like, I don't know, you know, taking drugs and tripping, you can explain this away rationally, but what happens inside you, there's no rational explanation that is sufficient.
Absolutely.
Or like falling deeply in love.
Right.
You can explain this rationally and like
on
a biological level and psychological level and so on, but if you fall deeply in love with someone, like rational explanations don't do it justice.
And
I think there is a built-in protection for the legacy system in that it affects language in a way that individual words become sort of meaningless. They start to become fuzzy. So given that we think in words, right? Internally, we think in words. If the words stop meaning precisely what they mean, and man stops meaning man, and woman stops meaning woman, it's harder to, when you encounter something new, and someone explains it to you, or you read about it,
right.
Because the words are a bit fussier. It's harder to get there.
But that has always and will always be a problem, because in the end words are just, you know, like signs pointing to something. They're not the real thing. It's like you can talk about orgasms all day long, but if you never had an orgasm, like, it's not the same thing. Like, the word orgasm is not the same thing like having an orgasm. And so I think you're absolutely right. There is this limitation. And so coming back to Bitcoin, I think it's also insanely hard to, first of all, describe what Bitcoin is in the first place, just using words, you know, like it's I was asking on Twitter, I don't know, a couple of months ago, do you think it's possible to understand Buddhism without practicing Buddhism, you know? And the reason I asked should be obviously, you know, but like the actual question was, do you think it's possible to understand Bitcoin without having used Bitcoin and becoming Bitcoin, so to speak, in the sense of running your own node and all of it? Because what you're doing is actually practicing Bitcoin. You're becoming Bitcoin. You're part of the consensus system. You are actually, and if you store your fucking seed phrase in your head, you are actually Bitcoin. You know, like that's what you are. That's what you become. Mm-hmm. Do you think it's possible to understand Bitcoin if you're not doing that? I think the answer is definitely no. So every outside explanation of Bitcoin is always completely flawed, you know? Mm-hmm. And every inside explanation of Bitcoin is 100% individualistic, you know? Just like a Buddhist talking about the Buddha and those things. I mean, of course, you know, you have a huge overlap with all other Buddhists.
Yeah.
But still, it's an individual thing.
Yeah, we were talking last night about the Vipassana and the meditation retreats. And my experience when I went there was finding a new word. This was way before Bitcoin, but it was finding a new way of learning where no one teaches you anything. Yeah. They just open an opportunity for you to explore, and they give you absolutely no tools. Mm-hmm. And you find, after a really hard, long process, you start finding truth on just your bodily experiences. And you start getting to conclusions and building from those foundations, building and learning stuff, you know, without anyone teaching you anything.
Mm-hmm. Funny, actually, someone, a Bitcoiner that I won't mention his name, but was telling me recently about Christianity from first principles thinking, and how you can arrive, and his contention about his faith in Christianity was strongly supported by the fact that he could independently from first principles arrive at the doctrine of God the Father, the Creator, and all of that. And I thought that was a very Bitcoiner way to think about Christianity.
Yeah, just with first principles.
Check your premises all the way down. Mm-hmm. And you know, the last thing that recently gave me such a feeling of destiny or a feeling with Bitcoin that's so bizarre is that some of the Bitcoin's properties are emergent. Right, mostly the immutability of the blockchain is usually emergent. Censorship resistant is as well. Privacy, not as much, but still because of the Anon set. And you know, there's a lot of talk about the blockchain versus the time chain. The blockchain is describing what it is physically. It is a chain of blocks.
The time chain is what it does.
And then at block number one, it was a blockchain. At block number two, was still a blockchain. At block number three, was still a blockchain and not a time chain, because it didn't have
the... You could rewrite it easily, that's
yes,
what I mean.
Yes, the properties of Bitcoin had not emerged. And then we understand that these properties, as emergent, kind of like gradually attach themselves to Bitcoin. But then there is one block that, when you go back in hindsight, is like, where is that block where it became the time chain, like the time chain, and it made me think of the human soul. Mm-hmm. It made me think of like consciousness. Like, okay, so if you believe that Darwin,
how many water molecules do you have to mush together for something to become wet? You know, it's the same idea.
Yeah. That's a very good point. And then
I think that's one thing that most people that don't have a deep understanding of Bitcoin have a very hard time to wrap their head around, because in Bitcoin, for example, there is no finality. You know, everything is probabilistic. Yeah. You know, like, If a new if a new proof of work chain would arrive and it would have more accumulated more accumulative proof of work.
Mm-hmm.
This is the history now. This is Bitcoin. Even if it rewrites all of it, like, that's the only way it can work.
Yeah.
You know? Like, checkpoints don't make any sense. Like, checkpoints defeat the whole system.
Right.
And so I think that's very hard for people to accept.
Yeah.
But once you, you know, crunch the numbers, once you run the numbers, so to speak, you will realize that for this event to happen, you know, like, it's so insanely unlikely. Like, it's what happened, what is recorded in Bitcoin. There's nothing else we can be as confident about when it comes to recorded history.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
There's so much compute hidden in these numbers.
Yeah.
Like, I don't care what it is, you know, like, the pick any world event, you know, like, any recording of any world event.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not as sure about that this happened than I am as sure about all the transactions that happened in Bitcoin a few blocks down.
Okay. Sidetracking a little bit. How can you prove that something does not exist?
Non-existent. I don't think it's possible to prove that, right?
Is it?
I don't know.
How can you prove that a double spend transaction does not exist?
Ah, well, it doesn't exist by definition.
It doesn't exist in the universe of the blockchain.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
So the universe is too large for us not to know what's inside it. We need to have a square, we call it a sand square. We need to have an area that's defined.
Yeah, Bitcoin is a sandbox universe, basically.
It's a sandbox universe, and it's like, does the...
Absolutely. Also, when it comes to time,
yes,
and all of it.
Yes,
yeah,
yes.
No, 100%.
So,
yeah.
So one of the times that I really understood Bitcoin was when I realized that Satoshi is the first person in history to give us something that we can prove doesn't exist, which is a double spend transaction or an absent chain. And it doesn't exist until it does, but we have this agreement where we're well, you know, and it's kind of like, it's a social construct, like the blockchain is a social construct which becomes not a social construct because it has a proof of work and the economic...
I mean, there's so many ways to think about this, and one thing I like is thinking about it as a game, for example.
Yeah.
You know, and just like, for example, like, before it was formalized, everyone, so like, just go 100 years back.
Yeah.
Everyone knew the rules of chess, but there was not a single body that defined the rules of chess. The rules of chess were emergent, and if you agree, you can play. You know?
Yeah.
And if you, someone can come up and think, you know, it might make sense to, you know, enlarge the board, you know, just have it four times as big and put more pieces on it, and it will be more fun. But you will not find many other people that will play with that. So that's like what a hard fork represents, you know. Some other things, like, you can use this metaphor very nicely to think about soft forks as well, you know. Like, you can, for example, always play the same opening. It will still be chess.
Right.
You just choose to play the same opening all the time.
Right.
You might be at a disadvantage.
Yeah.
You might can, like, you can make up new rules that are compatible with the rules of chess.
Yeah.
And it might be a fun game, you know.
Yeah.
Like, only move pawns. And
You can impose. You can make it harder for yourself.
Yeah,
essentially.
Exactly. And
I'm only
going to
dribble three times in basketball.
And what's funny about Bitcoin is it is like a game like that, but it is an open-ended game. You know, like, it's, you don't have rounds in it, basically. Like, not really. And so you will, like, if someone decides to change the rules in a drastic way, it will be a new game that you have to start from scratch and find other people and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is just like chess. You know, it has this. It is its own universe, kind of. That's the connection back to what you were saying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you have a very well defined set of rules, and some things are permitted in this universe, and everything else is off the table. Like, I can quote unquote prove to you that there is no pink elephant on the chessboard because I know where the chessboard ends, and I know all the pieces and so on and so forth.
Right.
And it's the same with.
Yes.
I can prove to you that there is no double spending Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like a game.
Yeah. All right, Alex, Remnant, final thoughts?
Don't ask me for final thoughts at the moment.
Yeah, no.
I had a reaction to the chocolates. So.
All right, well, the Remnant are definitely meeting. Bitcoiners are reproducing.
The only other notes I had on here was, like, if anyone wants to dig into the difference between Remnant messages and parasites, selective adoption versus mass adoption, narrowcasting versus broadcasting.
Oh yeah, that's actually
and
a good one.
And the hero journey stuff.
So I think, because, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, name dropping Udi again. A lot of talk currently about mass adoption and how Bitcoins are too mean and, you know, we will scare all the people away and so on and so forth. I don't think it matters because economic reality will take over. So it doesn't matter if you like Linux kernel developers, and it doesn't matter if Linus Torvalds is mean on an email or not. Like you're still gonna use Android, you know, like, or your router is still running Linux. Like,
yeah.
It doesn't
yeah.
matter what happens yeah. on the Linux mailing list, and yeah. I think people like Woody forget that. And it's in terms of I really like the term narrowcasting. To all the other insane people out there, don't be afraid to broadcast, because only the people that will understand what you're saying will listen to you anyway.
Yes.
So it's kind
but
of
you have to broadcast before you narrowcast.
Exactly.
You don't have a choice, because
exactly.
the broadcast is the different
exactly.
discovery mechanism.
And that's exactly what SAS job is also about, as you pointed out. You know, it's like if you're standing on a mountain and preaching, like. Only
most
those
people
who are
going to walk past
exactly.
you. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And there's a few that are going
to. For
yeah,
most
people,
you are going to
report,
listen
sense,
only if
you
don't dilute the message.
Exactly.
If you stay true
yes.
to your message.
And it is like narrative is important in the sense that Bitcoin's journey, I believe, is crystallized enough so that narrative doesn't matter that much. The narrative matters in the sense that it reallocates resources within the industry. So are we going to work on privacy right now? There's a fixed amount of resources and an infinite amount of projects that Bitcoiners could be working on. You know, imagine if everybody had worked on, I don't know, something else other than Lightning or something like that. It was a very narrative-driven decision to work on second-layer solutions as the way for us to scale Bitcoin. Otherwise, this is very well-crafted narrative. And if you think of Bitcoin, it's kind of like a bonsai, or it's kind of like a tree where it's very young and very soft. You can definitely make one branch go in one direction, and at some point, you can't move the tree anymore. So
yeah.
there was a very strong. That's why the remnant narrative and having a strong narrative of uncompromising was good, because we directed it at our colleagues in the Bitcoin space. You know, think about it. Like, I very rarely, when I talk about that, you know, I'm imagining all the guys that work at all the Bitcoin companies and all the guys that are like and girls that are thinking about ways to get involved with Bitcoin. I'm like, these are the ones that I want, all the gardeners of Bitcoin or all the caretakers of Bitcoin, to be on the same page. And the fact that the short-term cost of that, which is that some people that, you know, got repulsed, thrown off by the narrative, it's like, again, Udi, still mentioning him, because he has elected himself to be the cartoon character of the argument.
Oh,
so that's
he
what
truly
he deserves.
Is living rent free.
But listen about what we're just saying. Now we're building something that's as important as fire, civilization changing. It needs to be immortal, whether or not it is the end of all cycles or not.
The end of this chapter of cycles.
Bitcoin was inevitable because we were inevitable as people, but the Bitcoin is not inevitable if no one ever worked on Bitcoin. It would not have become inevitable. The blockchain was inevitable, but the time chain was not. The blockchain was the idea whose time has come. The time chain is just the metaphysical coming together of all these things. So it is really, really important. Because why would we talk to the other remnant?
I would also say that it's like a filtering mechanism, because you look at what the so-called toxic behavior has done. It's actually pushed the flakes out. It pushed Roger Ver out. It pushed Vitalik out.
Mm-hmm.
It pushed all these fucking idiots out. Taleb, all this shit. So it pushed that out of the system. And the most recent one was that fucking dumbass Chris Skye.
Mm-hmm.
Like, as soon as, and Udi owned himself with that one. He's like, oh, well done, maximalist. You know, you you did very well with, like, we actually initially embraced him.
Mm-hmm.
We're like, hey, come, you know, talk with us. You got his contact details, all that sort of shit. We'll try to get him on the podcast, all this stuff. So we're nice. Until he thought his fucking shit didn't stink. And then we called him on that.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happened a couple days later, after Udi was like, oh yeah, well done, maximalist, Mr. fucking XRP, Mr. fucking other shitcoin, literally fucking supporting the very organizations that want to maintain the fiat standard that he's supposedly fighting against.
Right, yeah.
Fucking
That guy, the problem with that guy is that he's just fighting a very narrow fight.
Mm-hmm.
He's just focusing on...
He's a foot
on
soldier. He's a fucking foot soldier. He's a fucking classic...
Mm.
He's kind of like an elevated version of the masses.
He's an ultimate nihilist, right? So his message is, look, we were always right, and then like we're right, everybody else is wrong, and there's nothing we can do about it. All we can do is prove. And I understand him. And the thing is, that's why narrative is so important about Bitcoin, is because I don't want people. You know, we make these extraordinary claims like we're going to save the world by buying this thing and sitting on our ass. And I understand his point of view, yeah, because he must be thinking, I've heard this shit from all the social justice warriors. I've heard this from everyone else. Everybody's saying that they're going to change the world and they're not putting in proof of work, because for him, proof of work is grinding. But it kind of is, you know what I mean? And the thing is, he doesn't have... Yeah. So I'm being a Chris Guy apologist because... that's why I believe the narrative framing of Bitcoin remnant no compromise is important, because other people that think like us, if they see Bitcoin narrative as being compromising and weak and soft, mm-hmm, and all of that, mm-hmm, they can be like another bunch of fucking weak ass bullshitters, right? And then he's gonna come back around for sure. Chris Guy, I believe, will in three years, he's gonna be the biggest maximalist.
Or in 10 years when he has to eat, you know,
like he will be a maximalist.
In the end, it doesn't matter too much. I think most people like Chris Guy or also Taleb and others, I think it's mostly an ego thing.
Oh no, it's definitely an ego thing.
You know, thinking you understand how the world works and thinking you understand, for example, also how markets work or how money works or what are the real root causes of things, and just not being open to the idea that what the maximalists are saying is actually true. You know, it sounds completely outrageous at first.
The thing is, this is like it is an ego thing, because he figured out the government, and I tweeted this, I said, Chris Guy thinks he's special because he figured out the government hates you last year.
Yes.
We figured this shit out fucking decades ago, and not only did we figure it out, but we actually built an entirely fucking parallel system that the government can't fucking shut down.
Yes.
And, you know, he's running around putting stickers on fucking restaurant things that just say no. Like,
but he's a remnant in his own way, and I understand. Imagine if you're surrounded by... You haven't discovered like Bitcoin Twitter, or you haven't discovered an internet community where everybody's like amazing and intelligent and engaging and all that. Your entire life, you're like, you have accepted that the number, highest number of people around you are idiots. So whatever the mass agrees on is probably idiotic. And then he goes on Bitcoin Twitter and we spam him in his environment where
we are the mass in we his look, point of view.
Right, from his point of view, we're just a bunch of masses because everybody's like piling onto his thing, and then it's just sad. That's why out of all for people like this, you only insist with people, and I'm gonna keep working on him. We sent a few texts. I'm gonna keep working on him because I want the message to be, to convince you to be a Bitcoiner is a gift, and I think that I want you to have it, right? And some people, they don't want gifts, and I believe that he should be rewarded for some of the things that he's done that I didn't do. For example, I didn't run across a country, so that's my way of giving back to him, despite his sabotage. It's kind of like a friend that you know did a favor for you when you were young or something like that, and then he's a heroin addict, and then you're gonna kind of like try to get him out because you have this thing. So Bitcoin, I don't want mass adoption, and if people refuse Bitcoin, they can go fuck themselves. But some people, I would like to save them 3 years. I think Chris Guy deserves Bitcoin at 50 grand. He doesn't deserve Bitcoin at 200. If he keeps on his ego, right, he will get Bitcoin at 200 if he keeps on the ego. But I would much prefer give him a little reward for some other things that I think need, deserve.
He'll buy
reward.
In at 500k. I'm not
hoping. Yeah.
there's a big component of the ego with him in particular. But I think the problem is that he's realized that he's been asking for permission to the government for his whole life,
right?
We've all been, and the government has been saying yes, you can go outside, yes, you can go to the park, and now he's reached the point where the government is saying no, you can't go to the park, you can't go outside. Mm-hmm. So what he's fighting is the no. He's not fighting for asking for permission,
right.
And that's what we're fighting.
Very good.
I don't know. I think it is very wise in terms of toxic maximalism to err on the side of including fewer people.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree. Mm-hmm.
Very similar to how Bitcoin, for example, is erring on the side of too much security.
Yeah.
You know, like we have no idea how much hash power we need.
There is collateral damage.
If you want to be frank about it, it's like 51% mm-hmm. of the Earth, of humanity's energy mm-hmm. output. Then we're good. Before that, not so much.
We're definitely
not secure.
Right. So the benefit of Bitcoin not compromising is
outweighs
the potential collateral damage.
Negative, exactly.
And then, you know, when you go to war, you're never happy that some innocent gets hurt, but at some point. And then that's why the toxic maximalist discourse, I see it as mitigating. It's like, we don't want to have normies that don't deserve Bitcoin coming in, and the cost is going to be that some remnant that may have gone in were completely thrown off by the discourse, or because if the Chris Guy situation has been handled a little differently, but then we can't.
It's just
a shame, right? It's just a shame. Chris Guy is a shame. There's nothing we could have done. There's nothing we should do different. And some people are going to not get it, and it's going to suck for them, and it's going to suck for us because we like them.
Like, it's impossible to get at first.
Like Talus. Like Talus, for example.
100%. It's just, you know, like, most people don't get Bitcoin at first.
Most people
think they're smarter than everyone else and go down the shitcoin route. Mm-hmm. Most people don't understand the profundity of it.
Yeah.
Most people don't understand how it works and the security behind it and why it's quote-unquote unbreakable and so on and so forth. Like, it's impossible to come into this space and understand it, like, in the span of, like, 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Even 2 months.
Yeah.
It's absolutely impossible.
Yeah.
Especially when doing it publicly.
Yeah, of course. It is, but see...
We're here for a reason, and we discovered it, and we did the hard work, and we were drawn by something at a time when much of the information that exists now didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was a couple, Pierre, Goldstein, a couple others. Like, there was fuck all. And to be honest, I had not even come across Pierre and Goldstein until much of my own thinking. Like, my entry was probably actually more like Tone Vase, and Giacomo Zucco was really one of the influences for me, because he's just super fucking sharp. And then connecting with you and Breedlove and people like that was my entrance. And like, when I finally came across Pierre and Goldstein, I was like, holy fucking shit, these guys were so far ahead of the curve. But anyway, like, we did that work, and this is where I guess you have
you had humility also. You had some humility there.
You have,
right?
Like, levels and layers of people who represent the remnant bloodline, call it, like the remnant type of person. And yeah, like, we knew there was something wrong. Like, you know, in my new article called Bitcoin is the Other Remnant, I quote not only the construct scene in the Matrix, but also the red pill, blue pill scene in the Matrix. And, you know, the Morpheus says that you're here because, you know, you know something's wrong. You know, there's
like a splinter in your mind.
Exactly. and like, that is the message that the remnant will seek out and actually hear and listen to, and they will take the red pill. And
also, one thing he mentions, I think, which is very important, is most people are not ready to wake up, and they will defend simulation, so to speak.
Exactly, that's the construct speech. So, and in that case, like, that is what represents the masses, and they until they've taken the red pill, until they've unplugged,
they are
our enemy. I mean, maybe the archetype of a Chris Sky
such
is
such a great analogy. They can be turned into agents at will.
Yeah,
I didn't think about that. That's
exactly what it is. There's a whole section in the article about that. But I was going to say, maybe Chris Sky is like almost, you know, the what's the fucker's name who unplugged but then wanted to replug?
Oh, yeah.
Cypher.
Yeah,
yes.
Maybe Chris Guy's like an archetype like that. I don't know, maybe.
Yes.
Like, you know, almost got there and then it's like, no.
Yeah. Well, that's the difference between, you know, there's a distribution curve, and then at some point you're in the remnant group or you're not. You get it or you don't at some point.
I've been thinking lately about what you just said, that any of the of these people can become the agent.
Yeah.
Actually, the system requires more and more and more people becoming agent, because it used to be that when the state, like 100 years ago, when the state was smaller,
yeah,
you only require the police and the military to find law as the source of morality.
Yes, yes.
And the rest of the people could find morality in different areas.
Right,
it was more ad hoc.
Yeah.
Whereas now you require science, you require education, you require academy. Everyone has to fall in line and comply. And the system requires that.
And eventually it's the entire world, like in Matrix 3.
Exactly.
Like it's all of...
It's sucking everyone.
Yeah.
And that's how you find people that might otherwise be, you know, nice people, but they put on their police costume and they go and just fight against people that maybe they agree with.
Yeah.
But the law and the orders say, well, you just have to go and beat these people because they don't have a fucking mask on.
Yes, yeah.
But... And it's so incredible, because you are seeing people, you agree with them, you know that what's happening is wrong, and you're the one wielding the sword.
Yeah. What we don't want is ciphers. We don't want to unplug someone.
Mm-hmm.
Then it becomes the spook. Cipher is the spook.
He's the spook.
But I'm not too worried. Like to me, like. You know, Bitcoin is a one-way street, and stacking sets is a one-way street. Like,
that's true.
I don't know anyone who went back on a fiat standard. You know?
No. It's
you're completely on Bitcoin, and it's like, if you have the chance to earn Bitcoin instead of fiat, you're gonna earn.
I mean, they're extremely rare phenomena. It's like the cipher thing, right? Where you go back, you forget everything. It's extremely rare. Usually, being unplugged means you're unplugged forever, or you die. Or the thing with Bitcoin is also, if you were truly a malicious, like, vile person, and then you discover Bitcoin, then you have this contrast where now you're, you know, Cypher in the Matrix is like, you can only discover that you're vile and malicious if you're unplugged, because if you're plugged, you're just someone else's, you know, downloading the scenario into your head. So those people are quite rare, and they are especially despicable, right? So if you become a Bitcoiner and then you spin on Bitcoin and then you move back out of Bitcoin, then there's absolutely nothing that could ever have been done, and all of the time that you were unplugged was a waste of time for humanity, and you should have plugged someone else, of course.
How are we looking, Alex?
We're looking good. We lost some videos, so we're gonna have to
You're gonna, you know, deepfake us all in.
Oh no! But you know what? If you put it on, all right. So let's end the discussion, I think, right now.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do a quick round table and like some final thoughts. We'll start with you, Pablo, and then maybe like final thoughts and where people can find you, and then.
So people can find me on Twitter. It's for the time being, because I'm thinking, you know, I hate the name. It's Pablo F7Z. So I hate that handle, and I'm going to change it.
But, you'll fall in love with it eventually.
I'm thinking something like mixing, you know, climbing and Bitcoin. So I don't know. We were talking about this with my wife. She suggested Rock Hodl or something. Like
climbing sets.
Oh.
Climbing sets, huh?
Oh, nice.
It's like stacking away.
Boom, just like that, huh?
Yeah.
So, first parting thoughts. I obviously listened to the first two episodes of The Remnant, and they were super powerful and super useful episodes. I was already here in, outside of Spain, but still they impacted me quite a bit. And I think one of the things that impacted me the most, it was that it was sort of like a call to arms a little bit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I've been thinking that it sort of plays a little with the Chris Sky thing. But I think that it's important for us as individuals to act on what we see.
Mm-hmm.
And if especially after what happened with the lockdowns, if you're still doing the same thing and just complaining on Twitter and that's the only thing you're doing,
mm-hmm.
or you're just doing more of what you were doing before,
mm-hmm.
and that's why you think, you know, oh, I'm still buying Bitcoin, so I'm fighting the system. If you were already buying Bitcoin, you're just doing more of the same. So I think it's important for people to understand that them as individuals have to have some kind of action to fight against this system, whether it's opting out, moving, or you know, whatever, or what Joel is doing with Untapped Growth, whatever you're doing, it has to be something material, and it has to be something real.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be something that you can point to, and you can say, because of what happened in the last 18 months or 2 years, and things are accelerating, I can see it, and I understand it.
Yeah.
And if you're just complaining more on Twitter, you're slacking. So I think it's important to say, this is what I'm doing because of that.
Right, right. And the call to Bitcoin is definitely real. I had one of the, I had a remnant find me in a series of ways. And then he was telling me about, you know, I feel like I'm locked. Because I have discovered I was a remnant by listening to you guys. And I'm following you guys. And his pitch was like, I'm just as good as you guys. Like, I can do shit too, you know? And I want to do that now. I want to orange peel some more people. I think a lot of people are getting this call as this call to action. And after doing the first two episodes of The Remnant, just side note, I'm sure this has happened to you, Alex. This happens to a bunch of, you know, the Bitcoin Twitter quote-unquote influencers. A lot of people came up to me and mm-hmm. they were like, thank you very much for The Remnant episode with Alex. And there was the one with John and then the one with Dave earlier on. And I think about half of people that come up to me and talk to me about this, they're like, I did not think that there were other people like me. Mm. I actually felt very alone, and I'm like rediscovering this thing. And the thing with me and Alex, and Gigi also as well, since we are, our broadcasting signal is like very, very strong. as a prophet, some of the remnant, you know, kind of.
We're doing
Isaiah's job. Well, we're doing Isaiah's job. And why, the reason why I'm so lucky is I know that I'm not alone for sure, because people come up to me as a center, like I am the avatar, and you know I'm the guy on, you know, people know, so they come
up to
me.
You're the guy on the hill.
Yeah, exactly. But then I'm like, by the way, you're like the thousandth person that has told me, literally thousandth person that has told me over the last few years that I thought I was alone, and then I realized. Yeah. So just so you know, there's another thousand that are saying the same thing as you are. So probably you would you would connect. And the thing is, there's not many of us, but there's enough, right? There's definitely enough. Yeah. I mean, think about how many people you know. You know, probably 200-300 people.
It's also growing all the time.
Right.
You know, like
that's the good thing. Yeah. That we don't need, for because of the nature of Bitcoin.
Yes.
We don't need to convince a majority. We don't need to convince a minority.
Yeah.
You can just connect
with
the people that are already where you are and have elected into the rules that you are running.
Yes, yes. So in Isaiah's job, he says, only two things you know about the remnant, that they exist and that they will find you. I can guarantee everyone here, they exist for sure. I think, like, if you don't believe it, then, you know, believe it. There's people like us, and there's probably not necessarily more than we thought, but because of the nature of the world, like, we are able, like, all my friends are remnant. Like, I don't have any close personal friends that are, I have some, but almost all my friends are remnant. So final thoughts would be, just, you know, there's enough of us out there to create an actual community, and to actually get together. And, optimism lies in the fact that the remnant are out there, and find them.
Yeah,
you know, find
Amen
them
to that.
Yeah,
I don't have a lot to add. Like, my final thoughts are, you know, like everyone's situation is different. So if you still have to stay hidden for whatever reason, you don't feel comfortable of, you know, like going to meetups, going to conferences, be very outspoken or something like that. If your situation doesn't allow it, don't feel forced kind of to do that. But I think, you know, the time is ripe for more and more Bitcoiners to come out. And I think more and more Bitcoiners come out publicly and in a huge way and so on and so forth. And I would encourage, like echoing what you guys said, to connect with people, you know, build your own networks, and also make yourself as anti-fragile as you can, you know, like just change your situations in meaningful ways, day by day, step by step, to, you know, like whatever it is, if you, you know, improve your Bitcoin setup, improve your general setup of life, improve your, you know, whatever have you, like income streams, whatever you need to do to make yourself more resilient. And it's, I know it can be very overwhelming at first, but just take it one step at a time. And that's what's so great about connecting with other people, because once you know you're not alone, and once you're starting building those networks and sharing information and other things, it will become easier. And I think that's what we need to do. And I think everyone kind of feels that we're close to a tipping point, and I can tell you when the time is ripe or when it is necessary to kind of you know, like to use a Brandon Quidditch metaphor again, when all the mushrooms will pop out of the ground at the same time. Yeah. But I think we're close to that, and I think just be prepared for those kind of scenarios, and then yeah, we'll see where the chips fall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my final thoughts, maybe two things, is like one, for every one of us, maybe I'll phrase it this way: for every 100,000 of them, there only needs to be one of us. Mm-hmm. Like that's the, you know, maybe it's a 1 to 1 million ratio that really matters. So again, I firmly, honestly believe, I wrote an article 2 years ago actually, which was like long before I knew about this concept of the remnant, or mm-hmm. long before you and I really connected properly, and it was called In Support of the Elite. And in there, like the main image is like Usain Bolt on one side and like a lizard on the other side. Right. And it was kind of like a troll at, you know, the whole elitist thing, which is they're not elites, they're fake elites. You know, they're jealous, and you know, mm-hmm. the elites are the, you know, the Bruce Lees of the world, the Teslas of the world, the Satoshis of the world. Mm-hmm. That's actually what elite is, and it is a matter of pride to be part of the 1% that matters. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I want to start to, you know, create a movement to change the narrative around being afraid to be part of the elite, being afraid to be part of the 1%, because that's actually always been what changed the world. Mm-hmm. And reading Isaiah's Job for me just hit home so fucking hard. Mm-hmm. Was that's the piece that matters. And I'm so glad that, like, intuitively, I mean, we all found each other by not diluting our messages, mm-hmm. by not deviating from that bit of truth. And we all could have had, you know, we spoke about it last night, we all could have been shit coiners, we all could have made way more money, we all could have had way more followers, we all could have all of that shit, but we chose not to dilute that message. Mm-hmm. And that's what matters, because we appeal to those, to the 1% that matters. So that's one thing. And then the other thing is, I want people to think bigger, and, you know, all the stuff that, you know, Mark and Laser and everyone are doing, like, I think is great, like with the waves and the cycles and everything. But I want people to realize that Bitcoin doesn't just break all the models; Bitcoin breaks all the cycles. This is not Bitcoin's not just the something that has emerged because we're at the end of a fourth fucking turning. Like, that is so small. Like, think galaxies fucking bigger, mm-hmm. in terms of what mm-hmm. this actually means. This is the end of all of those previous cycles.
It's the end of prehistory.
It's the end of prehistory, exactly. Yep. This what comes after this is a whole set of different cycles that we are yet to fucking imagine. Yeah. And I want people to think of Bitcoin like that, because that's how big this thing is. That there's like fire, Bitcoin, teleportation. That's actually going to be the title of my next article for Bitcoin Times Edition 4. Thank you, Francis, for, you know, for quoting that. But yeah, that's what I would finish on. So, gentlemen, thank you so much.
We're going to make it.
We are going to make it. We are going to make it.
Awesome. Bitcoin is going to make it.
GMI technology. That's the next one.
Yes.
All right, guys. Thank you so much.
All right, let's go!
Lunch time.
My legs are dying.
Yeah.
Oh my god, it's 1:30. Oh god.
Yeah, it's good.
Another fantastic fucking episode.
Oh no.